Welcome to Rereads. In a letter to his then 15-year-old son, Ta-Nehisi Coates writes as a deeply loving and deeply concerned father, trying to help his son understand the world he is entering into as a black man in America. In the opening pages, Coates writes, "I propose to take our countrymen's claims of American exceptionalism seriously, which is to say, I propose subjecting our country to an exceptional moral standard. This is difficult because there exists all around us an apparatus urging us to accept American innocence at face value and not to inquire too much. Between the World and Me is a difficult read that relates many uncomfortable truths about the experiences of black human beings in our country. It is a painful but necessary reading. I have read this book twice. I have listened to it as an audiobook two or three times. I have seen the recent film adaptation of the book. I have respected Ta-Nehisi Coates as a journalist, following his career as he wrote for The Atlantic. Having a journalist in my household, I see the same calling and mandate when I read Coates. The role of a truth-teller. In ancient Israel, these individuals were called prophets, a corrective voice to the nation, reminding them to be the people they were called to be. Prophets were often perceived to be cranky and poor dinner companions because their role was to hold up the mirror to a people who thought of themselves more often in a favorable light." Coates relates his experience and the experience of many black Americans as a parallel story to the narrative of white privilege and white opportunity and the reasons for those differences, as he discovers Between the World and Me. Now, to be fair, using the language of prophets may be an interesting choice to describe an author who makes it quite clear that he is not framing any of his observations through the lens of Christian faith. Coates does not want to soften the narrative by painting a veneer of religious sentimentalism, which makes the exercise of reading the book by someone like me, white, privileged, male, retired pastor and religious educator, a rather stark experience. But again, a most necessary experience because it's true, albeit drastically from my own experiences. I first read Between the World and Me shortly after it was published, at the recommendation of my journalist daughter, I might add. It was important to me to read about the experiences of people of color. Unlike my daughters, reading books like this were not in my literary formation. For instance, I am embarrassed to point out that all of last season's rereads were selections that were written primarily by Anglos. Yes, they're a mix of men and women, but they were all white. So allow me to explain the shift in my reading choices. About 10 years ago, I participated in a racial justice experience called Journey to Mosaic, sponsored by the denomination to which I served for 30 years. This was a 3-day bus trip visiting various sites of racial injustice in the Northwest. In between our stops, we would watch various films about the experiences of people of color and then have discussions as a group, I might add, of mostly pastors. Each of us was partnered with a person of different ethnicity from ourselves. My partner was a wonderful African-American pastor by the name of David. Time does not permit me to describe all that I experienced and learned, but let me say that it was a hard journey. It was difficult even as I went into the experience with the realization that I wear certain blinders in regards to my understanding of issues of race. It was my desire to have those blinders exposed and ripped away. What I did not consider is that, quote, a willingness of spirit does not spare you from the painfulness of truth. Those 72 hours were filled with intense dialogue where I frequently, I'm ashamed to admit, felt defensive and angry. So often in the circles I frequented, discussions about race were kept nice and respectful, which is another way of saying not altogether honest. After some years of reflection, reading, gaining new tools to understand the dynamics at play, I've come to accept that my participation in that event 10 years ago were a textbook case of the white fragile man. I was tempted to write off the whole experience as an unfair setup to make white people feel bad. Does that sound like white fragility? Thankfully, after more helpful conversations, I realized that I had a whole lot more to learn. Better yet, unlearn. What I needed to unlearn, what I needed to understand and take a hold of, was not more information, but reframing the way I saw the world. Like so many, I interpret the world through my own experience and lenses. I experienced a happy and safe childhood and teenage years, in part because I was insulated from the prejudice and injustices that existed all around me in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. As I lived in the affluent, predominantly white enclaves of Northern California. Did I ever experience or witness racial tension? For certain, but it was quite infrequent. Rarely, if at all, did I ever feel like I was excluded, judged, or on the outside looking in. Not to mention ever feeling that my physical being was in constant danger. I did not fear the police. The times when my friends and I were pulled over, the kind but stern officer just asked us to pour out our beer and go home and be safe. A vastly different experience than what I read in Ta-Nehisi Coates' writing. After the Journey to Mosaic experience, I knew that I needed guides to help me understand the lived experiences of others, particularly those who have experienced the violence and displacement of greed and racism, which I've come to understand go hand in hand. I needed to learn to unlearn. Ta-Nehisi Coates has been one of those guides. Coates writes these searing words to his son. I write to you in your 15th year. I am writing because this was the year you saw Eric Garner choked to death for selling cigarettes. Because you know now that Renisha McBride was shot for seeking help, that John Crawford was shot down for browsing in a department store, and you have seen men in uniform drive by a murder, Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old child whom they were both oath-bound to protect. And you have seen men in the same uniforms pummel Marlene Pinnock, someone's grandmother on the side of the road. And you know now, if you did not before, that the police departments of your country have been endowed with the authority to destroy your body. All of this is common to black people. All of this is old for black people. No one is held responsible. Did I mention that this is a very difficult book to read? That doesn't make it less true. Consider the other names that could have been added if Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote this book in 2020. Elijah McClain, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, along with dozens of others. Coates continues, "There is nothing uniquely evil in these destroyers of even in this moment. The destroyers are merely men enforcing the whims of our country, correctly interpreting its heritage and legacy. It is hard to face this." Here's where the lived experience of Ta-Nehisi Coates and my own experience intersect, and where I am slowly paying attention to what I have otherwise not understood in the past. It is a clear and present reality of many, if not most, black men to fear the police. "It is hard to face this," Coates shares with his son. And that is a difficult truth for me, who as a white man on the pinnacle of privilege is learning to lean into. I have wanted to push back on that notion. I have defended friends in law enforcement, trying to negate the argument by offering up examples of, "Yes, but what about so-and-so?" Truly, there are good and decent people who serve in law enforcement. But what I was not getting, what I was not listening to, is that black men and women do not feel safe around the police. I may not have fully accepted this truth, but deep down I knew there was some truth there. I remember years ago, and after an off-site church worship event, a member of our church, an African-American man, was to bring back the sound equipment from the venue and unload it at the back of the church. It was late, around midnight, and I felt afraid for his safety. Calling him up, I offered to help him unload the equipment at the church because I knew that his lone presence and actions would appear suspect to any police officer driving by the back of the church. My actions were not altruistic. It should have been disgusting to me that I had to be, quote, on the scene to legitimize his presence. I should have listened more to what was going on in me and used that experience as an opportunity to talk to others in my circle of influence. I should have been more honest with this gentleman, who is still a friend of mine, and talked to him about the experience of that night. While I had this sense of danger, it was still easier to cling to the notion that violence visited upon black men and women was isolated and circumstantial. The gift of Ta-Nehisi Coates' story is to help me see that I am not as empathetic as I thought. I could be quite empathetic to people who are like me because I have a base understanding of their experience. However, the work it takes to internalize and imagine the lived experience of someone unlike you is uncomfortable, to say the least. Simply, you feel stupid, and no one likes to feel stupid. When I was on that racial righteousness bus ride, it was a 3-day journey of being told, you just don't get it. I wanted to, or at least I thought I wanted to, but then there came the point of saying to myself, I'm tired of trying. Thankfully, I did not remain long in the lukewarm bath of apathy and self-justification. Coates spends a great deal of time describing the transforming experience of being at Howard University, what he often refers to as the Mecca. In my reread of the book, my attention landed upon a section where the author describes the ways of hate. One of the many benefits of his Howard education was the diversity of the human experience, but also seeing the pattern of reducing humans to coarse epithets. Coates writes, hate gives identity. The n***, the f***, the bit. Illuminate the border. Illuminate what we are ostensibly or not. Illuminate the dream of being white, of being a man. We name the hated strangers and are thus confirmed in the tribe. These are but a few short sentences that speak volumes. They are words spoken by a man who's been on the receiving end of hate, but who himself is also capable of reducing another human being as, quote, the other. I'm reminded of the words of Thomas A. Kempis, who said, let us seek to remove in ourselves that which we despise in others. You see, loving my neighbor begins, perhaps, in identifying in myself the ways and capacities of hate towards another. Jesus turns the tables on human beings' propensity to self-destruct in their attempts for forming community and identity. Who is my neighbor? Comes the question to Jesus by one who wanted to justify themselves, which I've also been guilty of. Who is my neighbor? The one I deem as the other, the one I need to be wrong so I can be right. The named hated stranger whom I use to confirm my position in the tribe. That is the one I must learn to love. Who does Jesus illustrate as the model of the loving neighbor? The one who is culturally, politically, religiously, and ethnically different than me. It still demonstrates practical love. Coming of age in the white evangelical world of the 80s, I was taught to fear and suspect two types of people. The liberals on the left, who believed nothing, so I was told, and the narrow, close-minded conservatives on the right, who sought to cordon off the church from all taint of progressivism. Both were suspect. Apparently, as I was told, we were both more graceful than those fundamentalists, while still maintaining our position as defenders of the truth in the face of those libs. Doesn't leave one much room in the middle, right? When I read this quote as cited above by Ta-Nehisi Coates, quote, "hate gives identity, confirming our position in the tribe," I'm humbled and see the arrogance that existed in me as a younger man. One of the more impactful experiences that Ta-Nehisi Coates shares with his son, Samori, happens when the young family is living in New York, and Ta-Nehisi takes his young son downtown to a live theater production. Exiting the venue, this child, Samori, did not exit the escalator as quickly as the white woman behind him would have liked. Laying hands on the child, she pushed the boy, telling him to move. It is important to see this incident through the eyes and experience of the author. Most parents, most white parents, have had the experience of needing to apologize to strangers for the actions of their children's misdeeds in public. Yet for this white woman to lay hands on the black body of this child because he was an impediment to her hurried schedule was entirely inexcusable. Her action flowed out of privilege, and the reaction of Ta-Nehisi Coates erupted out of the knowledge of that privilege. It quickly became an escalated moment whereby other white strangers, quickly defended this white woman against the words of an outraged black man. During the ensuing argument, the ultimate threat is leveled against Ta-Nehisi Coates. "I could have you arrested." Power had been asserted. White power knowingly leveraged against a black father who has watched his black son being mishandled. Power that daringly asserts the question, "What are you going to do about it?" If this seems like a one-off, a non-issue made by an angry father, let me remind the listener that just last spring, the same threat was leveled against a black man. Christian Cooper, an African-American birdwatcher, asked a woman in Central Park to please leash her dog as per the park's rules. Instead of agreeing that she was not following the rules, this woman proceeded to threaten Mr. Cooper that he had better back off or she was calling the police. And she was prepared to use false allegations to punish Mr. Cooper for daring to question her doing whatever damn thing she wanted. As I have reread and rewatched this incident, I've come to it with some renewed interest and fascination. I admit it. I have recently become a birdwatcher. With newly acquired binoculars safely draped around my neck, bird book in hand, I have begun to enjoy the slow and relaxing observation of birds. Yet, even this most innocuous of pursuits can apparently be threatening if you're black, especially if you dare to question the privilege of a white woman with an unleashed dog. The whole situation was deadly serious for Mr. Cooper as he filmed the aggrieved woman dialing up 911 to lie about a supposed assault so as to simply punish this man for questioning her right to do as she pleased. The experience of Mr. Cooper and the experience of Ta-Nehisi Coates were not dissimilar. Threatened white people of privilege can brandish an effectively known weapon. I'll call the police. Of the many lessons of 2020, one that I hope is absorbed and understood is that people of color have reason to live under the fear, more graciously, unnerved by the police or the threat of police. For Ta-Nehisi Coates, this threat becomes all too personal not long after his experience at Howard University. A friend and fellow student named Prince Jones was killed at the hands of police. Beloved and loving, Prince Jones imbued the compassion and grace of his Christian faith. The crime being worthy of death? being mistaken for a drug dealer. For Coates, the incident was not isolated nor just bad luck of being at the wrong place at the wrong time. He emphasizes to Samori that you are in danger as a black man in America. This is the message of a loving and concerned father to his teenage son. Your black body is at risk. There's a whole history and current sociology that forms the structure of that risk, while at the same time denying that such a structure or system exists. In ending his book, Coates relates the experience of sitting with the mother of Prince Jones, speaking of Prince's life and passing. In a sobering conclusion to the book, this father writes to his son, Samori, a name which means struggle. Coates writes, I drove away from the house of Mabel Jones thinking of all this. I drove away always thinking of you. I do not believe we can stop them, Samori, because they must ultimately stop themselves. I still urge you to struggle. Struggle for the memory of your ancestors. Struggle for wisdom. Struggle for the warmth of the Mecca. Struggle for your grandmother and grandfather, for your name. But do not struggle for the dreamers. Hope for them. Pray for them if you are so moved, but do not pin your struggle on their conversion. The dreamers will have to learn to struggle themselves, to understand that the field of their dream, the stage where they have painted themselves white, is the deathbed to us all. The last year may have moved the cultural needle from question to affirmation. From the question of, is there such a thing as systemic racism? To the affirmation, there is such a thing as systemic racism. It has been on full display. Perhaps this is what Ta-Nehisi Coates means when he suggests of how people who uphold their whiteness must struggle with the truth, that is, to be confronted with the truth of ourselves. I must ask the question that I have asked before. Why do we read books? And why do we reread books? My previously stated answer was in part to gain empathy, perspective, and knowledge about people and places we might otherwise would not have known. While I believe this is still to be true, there is something deeper that draws us further than the experience or exercise of, quote, mere mastery of a subject. Even the use of language of master is quite loaded. I am trying to sit with a different idea, paying attention to what I do not understand. For instance, I do not understand the experience of black men in America in, say, the last 100 years. I will never master the subject. I will instead be, to quote Thomas Merton, always but a beginner. As mentioned earlier, I started bird watching with a keen interest in raptors. But I know next to nothing. Despite the binoculars, the books, I find myself caught between wanting to know, name, and opine on a given species and simply catching a glimpse of a hawk or better yet, an owl, and saying, wonder, oh, would you look at that? I wonder if I need to pay more attention to what I do not know than just hold court on what I think I know. That I need to spend more time observing without feeling the need to dominate by opinion. Paying attention to what I do not understand. Learning to unlearn. Why do we reread books? And forgive me for repeating myself. Because our lives are not static. We have not yet arrived to an all-knowing state of being. More often we find ourselves beholding a mess, and we need help and perspective to understand. We need guides who will help illuminate the path and give some clarity to our lives and point us to a better way, seeking empathy and understanding. A prayer attributed to St. Francis expresses this posture. Divine Master, grant that I might see, not so much to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, not so much to be loved as to love another. For it is in giving that we now receive. It is in pardoning that we are not pardoned. It is in dying that we are not born again. So, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. A more recent poet, Amanda Gorman, spoke the truth of these words at the inauguration of President Biden. There is always light. Only if we are brave enough to see it. There is always light. Only if we are brave enough to be it. This has been Rereads, and my name is Kent Place. Join us next time as we look at Thomas Merton's book, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. Until then, be well, and remember, you can never step into the same book twice.